of the House Revenue Committee to order. Welcome everybody here this morning and all of our fine guests and members. What I want to do, we have several things on the agenda this morning. We have Representative Mabry here to speak to us on House Bill 2698. So, and we also have the Treasurer here to talk to us about the downgrade of Oregon's credit rating. That's the informational matter at the end of the agenda. What I will do is briefly open a public hearing on House Bill 2698 just to receive Representative Mabry's testimony, so we can keep your staff summary short.
Sure.
Okay. Then we'll come back and get the full version of the staff summary. Then we'll receive Representative Mabry's testimony. And then we will close the public, we will recess the public hearing on House Bill 2698 as soon as we receive Representative Mabry's testimony and go to Treasurer Randall Edwards' presentation since he is here. So, with that, I'll open the public hearing on House Bill 2698.
Dick. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Dick Yates, Legislative Revenue.
Thank you.
House Bill 2698 exempts retirement income paid by public employers who are not members of PERS. All right, so, and there are about 200 some employers around the state, some of which have retirement plans, and I don't know much about them, but anyway. Currently, the pensions paid by those organizations are taxable, and this would exempt those pensions attributable to work performed before October of 1991.
All right. Representative Mabry, welcome to Revenue.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and members of the committee. Thank you for your courtesy in allowing me to testify, and I will leave to go to my own committee assignment as soon as I do that. But I would like first to acknowledge Mr. Del Caesar, sitting back here, who will speak to you later on this bill. Del was my city manager when I first went on the city council of the city of the Dells in 1980, and then later served as mayor. So we go back a long way, and he's kind of carrying the mantle, if you will, for those employees we're going to speak of. Basically, my testimony is fairly simple. If you look at the bill itself, this is simply a matter of fairness. As you know, statute says that local government must either have PERS or the equivalent that is equal to or better than PERS. And there are a few, not many, but a few cities and counties that have opted to go with something other than PERS. Well, we got into this big flap with the federal employee retiring and the state employees not having to pay income tax, and there was lawsuits, and I won't try to go through the whole thing. But it was finally agreed to that state PERS employees retiring, public employees retiring, would pay income tax on their earnings as well as federal employees. And there was a bill to make a settlement of that. I would refer you to page, the fairness issue goes simply here. I would refer you to page 2 of the bill, starting on line 2 and running down to about line 8. And I won't read the whole thing for you. You can read it yourself. But it talks about federal pension income that is attributable to federal employees, da-da-da-da-da. Now I would refer you down to about line 36, and it merely adds qualified local government pension income that is attributable, da-da-da-da-da. It merely substitutes the exact same language for local employees who were not PERS members to be treated equally with federal employees. That's what it's about. It doesn't amount to a great deal of money, but, you know, if you think back to that old joke of it depends on whether it's my money or your money, whether it's a great deal of money or not. And for the employees that are affected adversely by not being treated the same as federal employees, it's their money, and it's an important consideration, I think, to them to be able to be treated equally as well as federal employees. They're certainly not second-hand citizens. They've done yeoman work in local government for a long time, and I just think it's a matter of fairness. So with that, I'll conclude my remarks unless you have questions, and expect that you will offer the same courtesy that you, to Mr. Caesar later on that you've afforded me. Thank you.
Oh, okay. Thank you. Are there questions for Representative Mabry? All right. Thank you very much for stopping
by. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
You bet. Good to see you. With that, then, we will recess the public hearing on House Bill 2698, and we'll come back to that following the next orders of business, which takes us to the Treasurer, Randall Edwards. Do you want to come on forward? I asked the Treasurer to visit us today about what has been in the news over the past couple of days with the credit rating downgrades by Fitch Ratings and by Moody's Investors Service, what that says about our situation, what it means for the future and the short term, long term, and a general discussion just about what ratings are and why we should care. So, Mr. Treasurer.
Thank you for that brief introduction of the reason why I'm sitting here. For the record, my name is Randall Edwards, State Treasurer of Oregon, and I do appreciate the opportunity to address this committee about the latest actions, one last week and then Monday, of our receiving two downgrades from two different rating agencies. There are three rating agencies, but two of the three have decided to take an action of downgrading the state's bond rating, and I can explain that to you in a second what that means. But I think what I want to do is kind of give you a context of what this downgrade is and what it means. The last time the state received a downgrade, it was in the mid-1980s, and that was largely due to the fact that the state had a program, the Veterans Home Loan Program, that was in financial crisis, and it was about a $6 billion crisis that the state was facing. We also had the throes of an economic recession or coming out of that, but it really was that program, and the rating agencies downgraded us at that time. It did take a number of years for us to come back out of that, even after rebuilding the program. So I want to leave with the impression that going down can be slow, but coming back can be even slower, depending on how we react and how they feel the state's faring. And that's what I think, to me, underscores one of the challenges that we face. The downgrade this time is really based more on some, what I would say, systemic problems that we face as a state in managing our finances. And again, we could pick up both in Moody's and Fitch, and we've passed those out. One of the things, which is an obvious statement, is we have a one-legged stool and basically funding most of the programs in the state of Oregon. That's an income tax, and Moody's really highlighted the volatility of that, and it's an obvious thing that we've watched that volatility on the downside. We also watched it go on the upside. So it does swing greatly. And again, these rating agencies not only look at Oregon, but they look at the rest of the country, and so they're looking at Oregon relative to other states. The interesting part, I thought, was they highlighted, in addition to, and again, there's a number of states that have, a few states that only use an income tax to fund the majority of their government functions, is that they said Oregon, though, has this unique kicker law, which is now in the Constitution, that prohibits the state, or has, at least in their minds, has prohibited the state from putting money aside, whether that's in a rainy day fund or having ending fund balances, to weather when a downturn occurs. And they really pointed that out, looking not only what has happened in the past, but into the future, because, again, this is a law on the books of Oregon, and in particular the Constitution. And as we come out of this recession, how will we, as a state, manage our finances any differently when you have a kicker law that would then, again, prohibit you from putting money aside or at least having the ability to put an ending fund balance together that would be healthy, and in particularly in light of having a very volatile income tax system. So, I mean, these are obvious statements of pointing out. They look at the short term. They see us going into the new budget with a balance sheet of having over $1 billion in liabilities. They're very concerned about the revenue forecast that came out. I think that's what really tipped the scale here more than anything was the March forecast that showed us down another $244 million. I know Tom Petowski's in the room. They also highlighted some concern about whether or not how accurate May will be, in which case we could see that ending balance, which we built in this package, potentially be considerably less than we expect. Our track record, again, is that we have had a very tough time relative to other states in keeping up with this recession, and how we've put our budget together was also of concern to them. They watched many states around the country, and again, Oregon wasn't unique in having to put together and patch together its finances as the floor kept falling. Using one-time money, we did raise taxes in this state. Many states rushed to increase their cigarette tax. We did delay some tax increases, but for the most part, we balanced by using some one-time money to get through this. That, I think, at least in my mind, we're pretty much done with all those one-time fundings, and they see that, and then they're saying, well, how are you going to continue to meet your obligations as a state? I would overlay one other issue in here that they didn't highlight, and I was before the Revenue Committee in the Senate yesterday. This has really been a cumulative thing. While they didn't highlight this in their report now, they have highlighted these concerns in the past. Things like the initiative process, again, something that adds volatility that can have an impact on the state's general fund. They've also commented in the past about ballot measure 5, 4750. I personally think that's one that is also an enormous challenge for us, and that is that unfunded mandate that we passed 12 plus years ago has really come to roost now, where we no longer have the ability, and we've narrowed down the tax base from a property tax to an income tax to pay for our public schools. That mandate alone, I think, is one of the key drivers to why we're having an enormous trouble balancing our budget today and into the future. We were not able to. The only way we were able to pay for that mandate at the time was in the 90s was this unheard of economy that we had seen not only in the state and this country, a stock market that went through the roof that nobody had ever seen in the past. And then when that party ended, we certainly saw the exposure in my mind of how are we going to continue to pay for critical services, and K-12 and that mandate certainly has come to roost today. So having laid this all out, I do think, and again, Mr. Chair, I appreciate the opportunity to be here, Wall Street's telling us something I think is obvious. That is, we have a revenue problem. Even in the good times, we're going to have a problem managing ourselves in the good times, and I think it's incumbent upon us to look at not only the short term in the budget, how we're going to manage ourselves in both in terms of revenue and expenditures, but the long term and how we manage the times when we're in the good times. I think this is a great opportunity for this body, and we have the opportunity to show not only Wall Street but the rest of the country that we can do something different here to make a change in the state and how we can manage ourselves in the future. I would contend, as the Chair and I have spoken, that part of that solution has to be looking at the finances of our state relative to our public school system, but also we finally got a rainy day fund. That's a positive. They see that as a positive. The governor's right that we've got to continue to expand our economic base and grow that to help provide the jobs and the revenues that we need. But in and of itself, we have also got to look at our own financial house, and that really, to me, is what is signaled here by these people from the outside looking in, giving us a very critical report card of where we sit today and where we're going. Again, I'm just delivering a message that they're saying. I was a little disappointed that we didn't get the opportunity, we collectively, you and the governor, to put together a budget and a package that could demonstrate that they didn't need to take this action. But I think their patience wore thin when they saw the continued drop in the state and then the cumulative, all these other factors that I outlined, saying, how's this going to change? And even the defeat of 28 was highlighted by Fitch in particular as putting another cloud over the political will of the state to make some change that they felt was important to again, bring some structural balance that they feel is much more healthy for the state than that they see today and into the future. So with that, I'd be happy to answer any questions. Again, the rating agencies are outside. They don't have any stake in the state other than to make a critical analysis of Oregon's health. What it will do to the state is that it will cost us more over time to pay for the bonds that we need to issue to meet the infrastructure needs of the state. But the critical point, I think, for all of us is the takeaway of it's at this point it may not accumulate much in the front end, but over time it can amount to tens, if not hundreds of millions of dollars over time if we can't change the situation in interest costs. But more importantly is they're pointing out that we've got an economic/financial problem that we've got to come up with a better solution than what we have today. So I'd be happy to answer any questions, and again, I appreciate the opportunity to be here.
Questions for the treasurer?
Yes.
Representative Burgess.
Thank you. Mr. Edwards, I just left a meeting of some folks, and one of the things that I'd like to just take a little bit more time on is explaining to Oregonians how you explain to Oregonians how important this is. Mm-hmm. It isn't obvious to citizens. It's like a report card. Oh, I got an A minus or a B plus or whatever. So in a few short words.
Sure. Well, I think I think you can look at this as a hidden tax or fee increase that's applied to the state when we go out to the market and issue bonds. It will cost us more because as the ratings dropped, our interest rates just increased, as does the insurance to issue bonds. So it is, again, our marketplace. We're now going to pay more to pay for the bonds that we need to invest, whether it's in our roads or schools, you name it, that we really have an opportunity to invest in using this tool. The other thing that's unfortunate is through my office, we have what's called the Oregon School Bond Guarantee Act, which has been very successful in allowing school districts to borrow against our higher bond rating, because many school districts, smaller ones in particular, don't go out that often, and when they do, they tend to have a lower bond rating and they have to pay a higher interest rate. And we've been able to let them come to the state and borrow against our better bond rating. They lowered our bond rating for that program as well, meaning that interest savings that has been helping school districts is disappearing. We've estimated about $1.3 billion that have been issued through that program. We've calculated about $100 million in interest savings, which, again, this is straight into local taxpayers. That's going to disappear, that advantage, and there will be likely fewer districts that will use that program.
Thank you. Representative Williams.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Treasurer, would you think it's an appropriate time in this legislative session that we begin the conversation about long-term tax structural reform in Oregon?
Mr. Chair, Representative Williams, I think this is a discussion that probably should have happened some time ago, and I think the sooner the better that you have a discussion about, and I think what these rating agencies are saying is you've got a one-legged stool, and you can take a look at that in and of itself, but it's also how you're managing those revenues when that stool is either, particularly when it's producing revenue. So I think in the paper today, one of the rating agencies said it would certainly benefit the state if it broadened its revenue source.
Thank you.
And as I recall, that wasn't from the report. That was a quote by one of the analysts.
That was a quote in the paper today.
Yeah, and just a quote by one of the analysts.
Who was the senior analyst from Fitch that downgraded us two notches. So I was very troubled by that, that Moody's downgraded us one step, Fitch downgraded us two steps, which is a fairly large jump. I think they're much more pessimistic, and therefore hence the drop.
Representative Barnhart.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. When they talk about when you talk about the one-legged stool, is the issue the nature of the tax itself, or as a type, or is it has to do more with the volatility of it, or is it something else that they're concerned about, or maybe all of the above?
Mr. Chair, Representative Barnhart, let me say the rating agencies are not going to tell you the policies that they think you need to approve. I mean, and how they understand there's politics involved in policy. They're just pointing out an obvious thing, which is we have, for the most part, and again, Moody's highlighted this, a very volatile income tax system, which, if you want to flip the coin, was doing extremely well in the 90s, in large part, again, to unprecedented growth in the state's economy, unprecedented growth in the stock market, stock options, capital gains. We saw this thing growing. Their concern, however, was, and when you look at around the country, there are very few states that have just that one stool, legged of the stool. And secondly, overlaying both an initiative process, which again drives vulnerability or variability that they don't like to see, with this kicker law. Again, the kicker is unique. No other state in the country, I think, has that, at least that they pointed out, in which case that really puts a governance on your ability to put any money aside to make sure you have a healthy ending balance. And that really was, when I was before the legislature last year, a little over a year ago, talking about the need to borrow for cash needs, that is part of the reason we have not, over time, been able to have ending fund balances that are healthy, and we kept driving that down to zero. And then when that party ended, we did not have any reserves, not let alone a rainy day fund to meet some of these needs. Again, other states, let me put context, other states are equally challenged. And I think, that, again, the Oregonian today pointed out some other states, a very few, have been downgraded. This is a national recession that has been unseen in the state country's history, at least according to the governors, since the Great Depression. So it is a national problem, but Oregon has risen to the top or the bottom, however you want to look at it, in being affected by this, and that's a big concern, is how do you change that looking into the future?
Thank you.
Yeah, I think this points up... it's complex, it seems. In some respects, the structure, if you look, we had the same income tax, the same tax structure in the 90s when our, until a month ago, and our credit rating was very strong, very good. But I think what's at issue here is the current recession exposing the inherent weaknesses in the system that are easy to mask when you've got revenue coming in hand over fist. It's a system that, as we know, because of its just elastic nature, when times are good, brings in a lot of money. But when the economy turns down, it doesn't have the structure to help sustain government services through a period of reduced revenues. And so in some respects, it's not the structure, because if we have enough money, it doesn't matter. The structure is almost irrelevant. But when you hit these times, I think it exposes the weakness of the structure. That gets back to Representative Williams' question that really needs to be addressed. Because if you don't have a system that's good for the lean times, you don't have a good system, because those lean times come.
And if I might add, Mr. Chair, the point is we have dropped about $2 billion as a result of this recession over a very relatively short period of time. That's a big number. And, again, that percentage drop, it puts us right at the top of looking at the states in how far down we've hit in revenues. And it's not only the collection, but then how have we managed when even in the good times, and, again, I think that was Moody's point of you're not able to put money aside. We didn't have a rainy day structure, and there were many of us in this building who've been fought over the number of years to get a rainy day fund. We finally got one, and of course we've drained it, which in my opinion was appropriate as well, because it's pouring in this state. But now the question is, how are you going to refill that? How are you going to make sure you have ending fund balances that are healthy? How are you going to compensate for what is a one-legged stool? And again, I think Representative Williams is right. And I think the timing now is as important as any to have this longer-term discussion.
Representative Bridger.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and thank you, Mr. Treasurer, for being here. I want to just touch on a few points that you've touched on and give you a little bit of my own opinion. Mm-hmm. And then I'd like a response to just the last part of what I'd like to say. In the first place, states with multi-tax structures are in trouble. So we can't just say that it is just because we have the income tax. Sales tax have not saved all states, if that would be one. The voters approved Measure 5 and Measure 50. So as elected people, we're saying, well, this is what Oregonians wanted, or did they? And is it time to relook at those or give Oregonians another opportunity? The KICA law is unique, but my understanding from the people in my district where the KICA law, actually their representatives were the ones that put it into place, and it was to keep government from growing. And they simply were tired of every time there was money, government continued to grow. And so that was my understanding of the KICA law. I'd like to repeat what the chairman just said, and it is a matter of money. And through this last decade, districts like mine that have tried to convince state government that we needed to diversify, we were overregulated. The industries that we had that were producing income in the state of Oregon were put out of business.
And this time we would have those dollars to produce for revenue for this budget when the cyclical part of the high-tech industry went down. And so I think that the failure to diversify Oregon's economy by overregulation of putting some businesses out created us. I think the thing that I'd like for you to comment on now is the crisis that we find ourselves in. I've never been one to like crisis management, and I bet you don't like it either. On the other hand, I do have the feeling that we're just reading the newspaper and saying we're downgraded. It seems to me that time is of the essence, and I'd like for you to comment on that.
Well, Mr. Chair, Representative Berger, I appreciate that because I do think there's an enormous sense of urgency, and I think if you're not feeling it, you should be. You certainly had to patch together very quickly a budget to get us through this biennium. Looking out into the next 2 years, your challenge is even greater. And I think there has got to be a sense of urgency on a multiple of fronts, and I think you highlighted it. One is, what are we doing in this state with economic development? It's true. I think, again, I didn't overlay this in this, but we did diversify our economy in that we grew a technology wedge much broader than we had in the past, and that did pay dividends to the state. However, your point's well taken. It's about the time the federal government started changing policy around federal timber lands and sales, and hence that whole industry started disappearing in the 90s. So, and again, from your district's perspective, that's been devastating. I think the challenge is multi-pronged. One is, how do we can change that economic course of the state, which is, there are some things that we can do. There are some limitations to it, but I do think that the governor is right in trying to focus on how do we improve that climate. But those take time. This isn't like a switch you can flip on and all of a sudden we have the days of the 90s. Again, a lot of the wealth generated in this state happened to be because of the stock market. Well, that stock market is not, in my mind, coming back, talking to people who watch this on a very close basis, the manager that I talk to, it's going to take time for that to recover for a variety of reasons. It's not just the war. It's the fact that we've got there are some global issues that are still inhibiting this country, that we have got a problem that's not turning around, not to mention corporate governance. I think there's some still governance or issues that are going to continue to keep that market from booming that we saw. And then we've got our own fiscal house. And, again, I think one of the keys you've got to ask yourself is, what do you want to pay for and how are you going to pay for it? And that's an age-old debate in this building. But I narrow it back down to, I really do think the K-12 situation is, and the change, and you're right, the voters passed Measure 54750, but the consequences of that really have not been truly understood until today, in my opinion. And I think, again, there's discussion about local option. I think that's part of the solution. But that is going to be another long-term discussion, and I think Representative Williams is hitting it on the head. How do we pay for some critical services? And schools has got to be right in there.
I'm going to pick up Representative Barr, and then Scott, and then Haas.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll be very brief. To tag along with what Representative Verger was talking about, we really are in a time of extreme crisis. My days on the school board, my days on the city council, crisis is all I've ever had. So it's, this is just kind of a normal thing for me. But what we really need to realize is that all Oregonians have got to open their eyes to the fact that we have a tremendous natural resource in this state that's not being used. If it were being used, we wouldn't be anywhere near the crisis we're in today. And we all have to consolidate behind the fact that we need to use our forests wisely. We have new harvest techniques. We have new growth techniques. We don't have to clear cut the way we used to cut in the 70s and 80s. We can do it and maintain a strong ecology. So I think Representative Verger is perfectly correct, and I hope that all Oregonians will take a look at what's happening right now. We're in crisis because we're not using our natural resources. Certainly we can blame the fact that high tech is down, but if even with high tech being down, if we were using our natural resources the way we were in 1988, we wouldn't be in this pickle.
Representative Scott?
thank you. I don't want to downplay the significance of the downgrade in rating of the bonds or of the credit rating. However, I think that tax reform may be an issue that needs to be discussed, but I also think that it needs to be in context, as Representative Verder has talked about, that there are other states that have more than one leg that are in similar difficulties. If you look at Moody's, you know, they make a point in their second paragraph that its inability to offset dramatic tax or fall off in tax revenues collections with reoccurring expenditure reductions. Part of the piece, in my opinion, is simply not to reform the taxes without making adjustments in what other essential things that we want to pay for and we need to do that. And I guess I'm not necessarily looking for a response, but in the same token, I think that if we truly are looking at reform in taxes, I think that we need to look at all sides of reforms and not just simply changing it and making it from one to two or three forms of income sources that will do it. I think it's a proven fact that in the same situation that Oregon is in, other states that have those multi legs, if you will, or resources to collect their income have exactly the same difficulties. The reaction that some may not be taking is the reaction that we may need to look at just as strongly as to what we're really willing to pay for or what the Oregonian folks are really willing to pay for.
But Mike, I appreciate what you just said. There is also the expenditure side, and I don't dismiss that again, is an area you've got to look at. I think even the governor's talked about doing different things differently in state government. That again, but those take time, and I think the sense of urgency is you're running out of time. Even you know, tax reform takes, if you were to go down that path, it would take time for that to go through not only a political process but even to get a change in the revenue stream here. And I think you've got to look at this in stages of what's possible in this building, the time urgency of putting a budget together, and I think you're going to have some revenue votes around that, and then looking longer term, what do you have as far as the long-term tax base and how you're going to pay for those services that you deem critical. And I guess I keep coming back to how our public school system is being funded. It's an obvious statement. When ballot measure 547-50, we just narrowed that tax base down significantly in paying for a major critical function of government, at least in my mind, to an income tax, which wasn't there 12 years ago. And that is also, in my mind, part of the solution is how do we make sure we enhance that? Because we know we have to, longer term, pay more into that system. The fact is this income tax system, as we've designed it with all these other demands on the state's general fund, I don't think you can sustain it. It's broken, and it's broke.
Representative Pence.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mr. Treasurer, for coming here today. I do agree with the sentiments of Representative Williams' question that we do need a long-term plan. The research shows that the states that do have a more diverse tax base, and along with the stabilization fund, are the states that do the best job of taking care of schools. And there's probably not anybody up here who disagrees with the need to eventually get to a long-term tax plan. But even if we could do that now somehow in the legislature, you're still talking, you know, possibly a year and a half or so before we get to a ballot or whatever. And I'm just wondering, given the urgency in what you're saying and in these reports from the rating agencies, what, until we get to that point, should be done immediately in terms of the revenue picture?
Well,
the usual answer to the point is, well, that's what you're there for.
Separation of powers.
That's right. That's why
you the separation of powers. Well, I think, again, I will say there's, again, I'm picking up the paper and talking to members. There seems to be a broader discussion about tax expenditures, what to do with the federal hookup. These are revenue votes. These have impacts on revenue short-term, long-term. Again, that I think is what the skepticism that you're seeing from these rating agencies at this point is. We know that you have certain demands that you have to meet to fund certain critical needs of the state. How are you going to do that when you continue to see revenues decline? The economy, and again, Tom's here in the room, and he can give you a better picture of that, but this economy isn't coming back quickly, at least in any immediate, at least in the next biennium, to a point where you can just sit back and say, well, we're going to be fine. And the rating agencies also pointed that out, that they don't like to see states only relying on an economic recovery to pull themselves through. They have even more skepticism about whether or not how quickly the state's going to be bouncing back. So I think in your budget, you have to look at both in terms of how the expenditure side, but also the revenue side. And I guess my concern is the means that we're trying to live within are getting so lean. I don't think you have the ability to find any more time money or make the cuts. And therefore, you've got to look at some revenues to help balance this thing.
Representative Williams.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess I just want to point out that I'm fully in favor of addressing with my desire that we look at long-term restructuring of our tax system, the immediate needs of achieving accountability on everything from PERS to other spending within the program. I think that is an absolute essential component of anything moving forward. Not only give confidence to the voters that we're looking at every possible solution, but also I think that makes our fiscal house look much more responsible when you don't have to show up, and also mention the fact that we've got a substantially unfunded liability in our public employees' retirement system that at some point we're going to have an obligation to have to meet. So I am fully in favor of that, and I recognize that some of the long-term tax reform discussions that I hope we have in this legislative session aren't going to solve our immediate problems. And there are going to be few really good choices for solving our immediate problems, in my opinion. We are going to have to look at some short-term revenue. We're going to have to look at some additional reduction in services that are going to be very painful for everybody in this state. And we're going to get through all that, and it's not going to be pleasant. But what I don't want to do is get through it without having put in place some long-term solution to where we go when we make it through this storm, and not to just crawl back up on the same old rickety life raft after we've been knocked into the water and get ready to ride it all the way through again. Now, I will say that other states are suffering similar problems, and there's no question. And if you all did your assigned reading by the chairman and you read Governing Magazine and you analyze every one of those 50 states, almost all of them are having some problems. But the states that have a diversified tax system are not suffering the problems to the magnitude we are suffering here in Oregon. And that's the distinction that I want to make, colleagues. It's the magnitude of the problem. It's not that we'll never have a problem. It's that we can address the magnitude of the problem with proper planning. And that's my proposal. That's what I'd like us to have a conversation about, recognizing that it's not going to solve anything in the 2003-05 biennium. The hole's too big and our choices are too tough, and there's going to have to be some short-term discussions. But, this may be all of our last session, given the choices we're going to have to be making. I'd like to make it count for something long-term.
Okay, let me. I want to thank everyone for the discussion and
thank you, Mr. Chair.
Treasurer, just to synthesize, I think what I'm hearing here is some different points, but I think probably moving all in the same direction, because clearly what's at issue here is not just our revenue or not just our revenue structure. It also has to do with our level of spending and our budgeting process. And I think right now. And also, our use of natural resource and the manner in which we've structured our economy. I think right now you've got the folks down in Ways and Means with their pencils sharpened and their green eye shades on, doing what they, in good faith, need to do, and that is, taking those hard looks at budget to identify, the core services and the efficiencies that they can squeeze out of every dollar that's down there. And, I hope in 2 weeks, 3 weeks' time, we'll have a chance to see what they're able to produce in the way of a budget based on current revenues, and we'll have a chance to say whether we like that or not. And at that point, that may very well turn the discussion then in a different direction. But clearly, it's complex. It's budget. It's how much we spend. It's how we pay for it. The structure by which we raise those revenues, and then it is also how we serve as stewards of our economy, right down to the natural resources and the revenues that we can derive from that. So it's a tough situation.
I think you have a great opportunity to do something here, and I encourage you to grab the reins and do it. I think you've got short-term, long-term. Again, the rating agencies are just another voice saying you've got to change your ways, and I appreciate the opportunity to be here, and if they can do anything to help you, we're here to help.
All right.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Okay. Let's get back on our agenda and go to a public hearing on House Bill 2705, which will be a nice segue from this discussion, I think, into 2705. Paul, if you give us an overview on that.
Okay. Mr. Chair, the 2705 is a committee bill, and it's was really based on a discussion you had on a report I was directed to do on the forecasting process. I've copied that memo for you again to refer back to. The bill does treat those issues and treats them in some ways you may or may not agree with. Just to remind you the key elements of that report. One is on the strengths of the forecast process we have, and you saw some reference to that as well in the Moody's write-up. The fact that there is a forecast that's reviewed by the Governor's Council of Economic Advisors, an outside body, highly respected economists that review the economic forecast. The revenue forecast is used by both the executive and legislative branches, so we do not have a dueling, competing forecast system as some states do. And finally, that there is a regular updated quarterly forecast that everyone's aware of the cycle, and so there's timely information for you to make planning decisions. In terms of the recommended changes on the structural side are largely incorporated in House Bill 2705, and those recommendations were to establish a new revenue forecast board and to create a new revenue forecast advisory committee. And those are the key elements of House Bill 2705. And if you look at Section 1, it establishes a new revenue forecast board. Four members on that board, they're appointed by the Senate President, the Speaker, the Governor, and the State Treasurer. It refers to members of the board to have expertise or experience in matters of economics. So it's pretty broad, but it's intended to be a nonpartisan professional board aware of economic forecasting and revenue issues. The board is not entitled to compensation. There is a no fiscal impact on this bill. The board is to serve two-year terms. The duties for the board is to recommend to the governor a qualified person to serve as state economist. One of the issues that's come up and is the whether the board would recommend one or multiple candidates for the governor to select from. The board is to appoint qualified persons to a council of revenue forecast advisors. I'll talk about that in a minute. And then it is to receive a quarterly economic and revenue forecast. Recall one of the issues that has come up in the forecast process in the interim is the sense of who gets the information first. And one of the objectives of the board is to ensure that the legislative leadership and executive branch leadership receive the forecast simultaneously, so there's no sense of one group having information before another. On Section 4, it does create the position of state economist in statute now, which it is not currently in statute. The state economist is to be appointed by the governor, so there has to be a single appointing authority. And again, the recommendations come from the board. It goes on to specify the duties of the state economist, which are essentially what they are now. And then the Section 5 refers to the Council of Revenue Forecast Advisors. The Council of Revenue Forecast Advisors is to be appointed by the forecast board and based on recommendations from the state economist. And the council's role is, and this is something I think you need to think about as you look at the bill and whether it's how you want this system to work. The council under Section 4, there, Section 5, Sub 4, the council shall review economic and revenue data and advise the state economists on economic projections and revenue forecasts. So the issue really that comes up there is the relationship between this
revenue forecast advisory group in the current Governor's Council of Economic Advisors, which is one of the things in my memo I recommended mm-hmm. that is a strength of the current system. So that would be an issue. Another issue is in terms of we talked a little bit about open meetings law and whether this would be workable when you get down to the hard revenue numbers in an open meetings kind of a process, was particularly in those critical forecasts used for the governor's budget and for the May 15 legislatively approved budget.
Where is that addressed in the budget?
That is not addressed.
Not addressed.
There is not a specific reference to the open meetings law. It is something we talked a little bit
yep.
about, so I'm wondering if that's
okay.
an issue you want to bring up as well. And, Mr. Chair, I've asked the Director of Department of Administrative Services to be here, Gary Weeks, and Tom Potowski to comment on the bill.
All right. Gentlemen, come forward, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Good morning, members of the committee. I'm Gary Weeks. I'm the Director of State Government Operations in the Department of Administrative Services, and with me is Tom Potowski, who is the state's economist. And it's a little sobering to be here with you after that presentation by the Treasurer right now, but we do appreciate the chance to talk with you about the governor's view of this bill that you're considering this morning. And we did actually have a good conversation with the governor about the bill. Came away with the sense from him that there's much to agree on within this bill, and then there are a few things, and Paul's hit on a couple of them that we'd like to have you further consider. But I think one of the first things I need to tell you after that conversation with the governor is he has two priorities in any conversation that we have around this bill and others that deal with the forecasting, and we think they're probably priorities that you share. But the first of those is that we continue to do whatever we can to not politicize this process of forecasting. I mean, we are fortunate to be in a state where we don't have dueling forecasts and where the independence of the economists and the forecast process is of great value to us. And even to the extent that, as Paul and I have talked, it's mentioned in the Moody's report, the value of the independent forecasting analysis that goes on in Oregon. Unfortunately, we haven't made our forecast, but the process has been one that most recognizes as being pretty valid and of value to the state. So that's one of the governor's concerns. The second is that he has this belief that we've gained a lot from the Governor's Council on Economic Advisors over nearly 23 years now. It was created in 1980 by an executive order. And the people that have served on that are, as Paul has described, some of our best minds in terms of economic and revenue forecasting. And the governor really would like to see us find a way in whatever we do in the future to keep that group as a core and pivotal group for us as we do our forecasting. Now, that may mean thinking about evolving their role from what it has historically done. It may mean adding new duties. And one of the things I want Tom to spend a few minutes with you on here shortly is how we have used the Governor's Council in recent years and some of the things that they're beginning to work on now that are a little different than they might have been historically. So with those priorities, which we think the legislature probably shares with us, let me just talk a little bit about the bill itself. First, I think we have general agreement around the board. The governor views the board as an appropriate forum for the release of the revenue and economic forecast. I mean, we understand and appreciate the frustration that has occurred and the perception that has occurred in this building that there are first among equals in terms of who gets the revenue forecast and so on. And we don't want that to be at play here. And the board represents a good forum for the revenue forecast to be presented to all the interested parties at the same time. So we think there's some real value in that. We think there's, for the governor, also some real value in having the board present to the governor some recommendations when we need to fill the state economist job. I guess we would urge you to consider whether that be a recommendation, which sort of forces the governor to accept or reject something that comes from the board, or that it be two or three people that the board feels are qualified to hold the job based on their experience and so on. So that's something we'd ask you to think about a little bit. With regard to the
board of advisors. As I said, I think it's important for you to understand how we've used the Governor's Council in the past because of its long-standing work and the value that many people have placed on the contributions of people that have served on the council. So at this point, I'm going to ask Tom to talk with you a little bit about their work and how we sort of see the council evolving. And there may be opportunities here within this bill to cross-pollinate a little bit, you know, to not lose the work and the historical impact of the Governor's Council and still take advantage of bringing more of the revenue forecasting into what has historically been really an economic forecasting responsibility of the council.
Okay. Welcome back.
Mr. Chair, members of the Revenue Committee, for the record, my name is Tom Petowski, state economist with the Office of Economic Analysis. Very briefly, always when we've come before you, we've usually have talked just very briefly about the Governor's Council of Economic Advisors. It's a group of 12 members from the community mostly, but we also have some academics on there. But as Paul's described too in the past, these tend to be some very smart people that have looked at the economy, are professional economists, both in terms of economic theory, policy, forecasting aspects, and then also they also cover quite a bit of industries, forestry, high-tech, electrical utility, retail. So we get a good cross-mix, too, for different industries. And they're traditionally, the process has been that we would meet twice each quarter. We would have what we'd call our preliminary meeting, and generally we met in Portland. We would discuss the national economy. We discuss what recently were some employment numbers and changes in the Oregon economy. And we also use a national forecasting service that also provides us with information that feeds some of our models that help us then forecast the Oregon economy. We would discuss those. Sometimes we might have a guest speaker also come in on occasion. But then we would go back with that information. We would work out the economic forecast. Then we would come back and have a actually full-day meeting. We also have another advisory group, which is the Department of Administrative Services Economic Advisory Committee, which is made up of mostly government agencies that are both our clients and that we get information from to do our forecast. We have two-hour meetings in the morning. In the afternoon, we meet with the Governor's Council again, and then we review and then show them our preliminary economic forecast. We debate back and forth. And by the way, I should say, in between all these meetings, there's at least 30 or 40 emails flying back and forth among all the members discussing various issues, items that have happened in the economy. So it's really a not just a two-meeting aspect. It's always ongoing, almost daily. Then they give us their take on what they believe the forecast is. They'll have debates on whether it's they think it's too strong, too weak, so on. Is it just about right? And then we take that information. So at this point, and this is traditionally since really 1980, there really wasn't much discussion among the Governor's Council of Economic Advisors on the revenue forecast. It was sort of solidifying the economic numbers because once those are solidified, then they will be presented in our revenue type modeling to be used for that forecasting purposes. But that practice has actually changed. The members have shown an interest in knowing a little more about the revenue forecast. We have formally presented to them our revenue methodology, and the discussion has slowly evolved now where we're starting to discuss some revenue issues with them. Now, as Paul has mentioned, our meeting that we have here in Salem is a public open meeting. I think in the past that has hopefully kept down aspects of revenue numbers getting out, but unfortunately I think it's also spawned the rumors of what the revenue forecast will be, whether it's going to be up or down. So I think that is an issue where at least I have felt more comfortable, by the way, with the economic forecast being more in the public domain because it did cut down a lot of rumors. Even though there were still preliminary numbers, it tended to sort of soften any change or if people might see a surprise because rumors are just that, just are the rumors. So I just wanted to let you know that with the Governor's Council of Economic Advisors, these people get no compensation. I usually go to Zupan's in Portland and get the best pastries I can find and provide that as compensation out of my pocket. They are dedicated to public service. I had a couple of members already come up to me and say, you know, if there is this revenue committee, we would like to be on it because we're interested. We're in those kind of issues. So in my mind, expanding out their functions would both give them, I think, more of a ownership in their role of public policy to the state. I think we can also keep them on the board because their time is very, very dear to them.
All right. Thank you. Questions for these gentlemen, Representative Hanks?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I certainly wouldn't oppose creation of these boards or councils here, but what I think a lot of people would like to do is we talked about the methodology and improving the accuracy of these somehow, and I don't see that in this bill, or whether maybe that would be something that these boards would work on. And we talked about either changing the entire way the forecasts are done or making the model more sophisticated and also making it more flexible. So as we've talked about before, Tom, that a forecast could come in within $100 million range or something like that, so that we're not pinned down to the penny on some of these, because these are so enormously important given the kicker laws and all these other things that go into motion given the exact to the dime forecast.
Mr. Chair, Representative Haas, we've actually have moved in the direction of exactly giving the range of forecasts. In our March forecast, we do provide ranges now, where we didn't in the past. There was a question about how many numbers are out there. We don't want to have too many numbers floating around. And as I've said in our testimony on February 28th, we think that it's our job to explain the numbers. And so having a range is exactly then quantifies the risks we've always been talking about. So definitely that would always, I believe, going forward, that's always going to be a part of our forecast, is giving this particular range and updating that range, too, should conditions change. The bill, it does address the revenue forecast advisory committee. And I'm seeing that as a more technical group, where we have both practitioners, tax practitioners in there. There's about, say, top 20 companies really influence what corporate taxes are going to be. And to get some tax manager from one of those companies that has ability to speak some freely or in more aggregate sense would be great to have on that committee. And then also some of our council members, governor's council advisors. These people are experts in forecasting and the tools that are needed for it. And so the assistance that they could also then give us on that leg I think would be very useful.
Mr. Chairman, let me add to that, Representative Haas. I think it's important to say the governor is more than willing to look at, you know, the methodology and so on. That this bill doesn't do that. And so we didn't presume to bring you into this bill those kinds of changes, but certainly we're more than willing to sit down and talk about strategies around the methodology. And as Thomas said, I mean, we're already doing range forecasting right now. And we have to, as we think about a change in the methodology, we have to be mindful of how that fits with the current constitutional kicker law and could be managed within that current law.
And I think in terms of you know, not changing the process so much, but maybe augmenting the inputs. I mean, you've got the Council on Economic Advisors that you've described that meets and works on the economic forecast input. What they don't have is the kind of that beefed up revenue input component. And that's what this is really getting at, to try to not directly, but by, I guess, providing this level of expertise and institutionalizing it as part of the process, strengthen the revenue inputs coming into the forecast and hopefully by that improve the forecast, but not by restructuring how the forecast is being done. I mean, is that about accurate in terms of the impact this would have?
Well, Mr. Chairman, I think that's the impact we view it having.
Yeah, yeah.
There's a different discussion about do you want to change
right.
the methodology, and which may be a necessary and legitimate conversation to have at some point, but it doesn't seem like that was not the purpose of your bill here.
This is to strengthen the revenue component of the input into the forecasting process.
Mm-hmm.
Representative Barr.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. on a slightly different note, I too am in favor of statutizing or institutionalizing the board and the commission and the position of the economist. But I'm trying to grasp what the full value of the direction that we're going to be going with this in the future is. And, you know, we've heard pretty compelling arguments regarding the magnitude of our crisis in Oregon currently being exacerbated by the fact that we have this one-legged stool that, that's been our revenue policy. In any way, do you foresee this board having any role in alerting the legislature or decision-making bodies to how existing revenue policy could affect the magnitude of future crises? It's a slightly different look at things, and it seems to me that, hindsight being 20/20 vision, we should have done something about this one-legged stool that we're all talking about now quite some time ago, and hopefully we have very, very smart people who are giving us advice that can help us foresee potential problems. Even when the revenue forecast looks good, you know, foresee what might happen if certain events take place.
Mr. Chair, Representative Farr, I would see that as a role of that forecast revenue board, depending on the people that is chosen, the governor's office, treasurer's, you know, Speaker of the House and Senate President. Those are issues that could be brought to my office and said, you know, can you give us a position paper on this? Let's have discussion about it. I see that's very, very appropriate for that group to do that.
I'm certainly glad to hear that.
I'm thinking like in the way you present the forecast, for instance, that on the economic side, we have that slide that always shows us the risk factors. You know, I could see something like that on the revenue side, incorporating any structural issues that the board may see from time to time that should be included as part of the forecasting process.
Thank you.
Representative Virgil.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. You know, I don't know what it is about government, but they love to get together and have all kinds of groups and all kinds of levels of meetings. I found that frustrating as a mayor, and I find it frustrating as a legislator. I'm always willing to go along with doing things better. Section 5 says the council shall consist of an indeterminate number of members who are appointed by the Revenue Forecast Board. And then I look right down and I see two objectives of the governor: do not politicize. Well, you've just laid yourself open for a wonderful politicizing by an indeterminate number of members. Some of the commissions and committees that we have seen appointed in the state have as many as 45 people who are all over in the Willamette Valley on the restoration. I think there were about 45 people that were on advisors. I just don't think that's necessary. I'm sorry to be the kind of fussy one here today, but I don't think that's necessary. I think that to do something on the revenue side would be very, very, very helpful, and I think to limit it to some very, very smart people. If you want to get advice from other people are always very willing to come in on either by report or something without forming a large meeting of people that they have to come together and spend some time discussing it. I don't object to getting advice. I just object to this kind of thing. The other thing is that I didn't see, where does the Economic Development Department actually play into this? Do they get the final reports? Are they in any way involved in any of the economic forecast side that you're doing right now?
Let me tackle the first part of the question, and I'll leave the Economic Development Department to it, because I think, Mr. Chairman, Representative Verger, we agree with you. I mean, we don't want to be in an environment where, you know, we've never seen a group, a committee we didn't like. Right now, as I think what Tom has said to you earlier, is we have a Governor's Council, and we have a Department of Administrative Services group, which is made up of state people. This adds a board, a revenue board, and it adds an advisory board on revenue forecasting. And so what we're urging is let's take a look at that and find ways to combine some of these things. We have, we think, a very effective Governor's Council whose mission may need to be expanded, and is expanding even as we speak and stuff. So maybe there's a way to use our existing Governor's Council, create a subgroup within that on revenue forecasting, or call it the Governor's Revenue and Economic Forecast. But there are some ways to think this through that don't wind up with four different groups instead of the two we have right now. So we're complete agreement with you. One of the amendments that we would urge you to consider here is with regard to Section 5. To have an indeterminate number is sort of an unusual way to create a group, because it can become pretty unmanageable in some ways. But we also would ask you to think about the role of the governor in appointing some of these members. So if you had, for example, a 12-member group, half of those could be appointed by the governor and half by the board itself, because this legislation now gives the board the full authority to appoint all the advisory members in any number that you may choose. So I think we would ask you to consider fixing a number, and then what role the governor ought to have in some appointments. In many cases, you find these are jointly appointed boards, and so there are models out there to be used in that way. So I think in summary, Representative Bridger, we have some of the same reservations you do about creating more than the needed number of advisory groups. And let me ask Tom to talk about your specific question on the role of the Department of Economic and Community Development.
Mr. Chair, Representative Bridger, the economist with the Oregon Economic Development Department is part of our DAS Economic Advisory Committee that meets with us quarterly. Part of their assistance for us is they may not be able to divulge a certain company that may be coming into the state, for example. But they can tell us that in this particular industry, we may see a new plant being sited. So that which possibly our historical employment forecast would not pick up, and various variables that we use for that. But you need this sort of institutional type knowledge that then you can adjust the forecast for that. Or they know of a particular firm that most likely will be leaving the state. They may not have liberty to mention that. We, on the other hand, for their part, we can take a look. We see certain industries. We know certain things that may cause this industry to, say, falter in the next 6 months or year. This also can be a signal to them that possibly this is an area in terms of retaining businesses that they may need to look at in the near future, that they may be experiencing some trouble, or what is the trouble that they're experiencing.
Can I follow up, please? This group that you refer to are the group of agency representatives who come in the DAS group. Mm-hmm. Is that the extent of the Economic Development Department's participation in this process? Is their input at that time? And I can certainly see that would be very helpful. We all have code names for the companies that are coming in, and that would really benefit you. But is that it for that department?
Mr. Chair, Representative Bridger, I would say that's the main function. It's not the only function. We have worked back and forth with them, in essence, outside of the forecast process. You know, looking at tourism, what's the possible impact on the economy, those sort of questions, which are difficult, especially tourism, to put into a forecast, because we do it by industries, and it cuts across so many different industries. So those sort of discussions go on between us, but when we're really more narrowly focused on the forecasts alone, it's basically the way I described it.
Okay. Representative Hobson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I certainly think there's nothing wrong with getting this into statute. My question, Tom, if you've mentioned several times an evolutionary process that is currently taking place in the Governor's Council, and being cognizant of what Representative Bridger said, isn't there a way to kind of merge this together so that we don't become redundant with a number of committees and have one committee that would indeed look at the revenue in consort with the rest of it. Can't we work all that together?
Sounds like what you've been suggesting we try to get to.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hobson. I think the evolution has been, just as I described it, where the Governor's Council has been brought in more asking and talking about the revenue issues. And I guess I see that the way the bill is written here, the Revenue Forecast Advisory Committee would look at both the economic and revenue forecasts. So there's the economic advisors are already looking at the economic forecast. So there's a double duty, in a sense, on that aspect. So I think if combining these concepts of the two groups, possibly, as Paul had mentioned, you could have a subgroup of the governor's council plus the kind of people I just mentioned, tax managers from a large corporation in town and tax practitioners. Probably a tax lawyer would be advantageous to have. Those sort of some of the institutional stuff that is very hard for us to be able to gain unless we talk to these people. So, yes, I at least in my opinion, some meshing together of these functions would be great.
All right. Anything else?
Mr. Chairman, can I just I want to sort of echo something that Paul brought up to you. There's a question here around how public some of these conversations are that has yet to be resolved, and I don't believe we have a recommendation for you at this point, but it is certainly a question that needs to be resolved at some point. Yeah. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Virgin?
Yes, just a couple of things. One, are we going to address the part about who recommends, whether it's one or three, for the state?
Mm-hmm.
We've spotted that as an issue to deal with.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And the thing. All right, Mr. Chairman.
Okay. Anybody else wish to be heard on House Bill 2705? I'll ask Paul to continue in conversation with you two, and I'll follow that along, and we'll see if we can get some work on this and back to us.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, very much.
Thank you. Close the public hearing then on House Bill 2705, and let me reopen the public hearing on House Bill 2698 and invite Mr. Caesar from the Dalles to come forward. Mr. Caesar, if you'd just introduce yourself for the record, and we'd be glad to hear from you.
My name is Del Caesar. I live at 603 Pentland Street in the Dalles, Oregon. And I was here last year, but I'd like to review. There are new members on here this year.
Sure.
8 years ago, when the governor, Kitzhoffer at that time, was in the Dalles at the Interpretive Center for an open public hearing, I presented this problem of the City of the Dalles employees who retired before the 1991 deadline or whatever it was, and PERS employees all received a check for taxes paid or not paid. I don't know. I don't understand that part of it. But he said, "You mean you didn't get a rebate check or whatever it was?" And I said, "No." And he looked at Representative Montgomery at that time, and Bob is no longer here, and Ted Ferrioli, our senator, and they both said, "Yes, that's right." And so he called for Miss Katie Kova to get up, and he said, "Ask me to go out and talk to her," that he didn't believe this could happen. So I explained to Miss Kova the problem, that we are not part of PERS. And so then they said, "Well, you have to bring it to the legislature." So I came, it was near the end of the legislature, and so the next year I came and was running from here to there trying to find out what I was supposed to do. And finally, I just called up Katie Copeland and said, "You know, I'm not getting anywhere." And she said, "Well, you have to have a bill." Oh, so when I went to Representative Montgomery, I was 4 days late from the deadline of drawing up bills. So that shut that a year off. So last year, Representative Patty Smith was in town running for the election, and I had a long talk with her. So when she was elected, the bill was drawn up, and I was here last year before this committee, explaining the problem, and there are approximately 9 of us now, there are 10, one of us have died, and that we are not asking for any favors, we're just asking to be treated like other public employees. And then along that, then the federal employees also came in here, and they are not PERS people. And so this committee at that time unanimously approved and forwarded it to Ways and Means, I believe it is. I presented it to Ways and Means. They formally approved it and mailed it to the House. And Patty Smith, our representative, presented it to the House, and it was overwhelming majority, approved it and sent it on to the Senate. But I was so late last year that by the time the Senate got it, the committee wouldn't hear it because they were running out of time. So this year I talked to our representative, John Mabry, just after the election, and he said he couldn't do it, but he called Representative Smith, who could do it before he was. And so we're a little earlier this year, so hopefully if you people agree and it goes on, maybe we can get this through this year. There's this is my fourth term down here begging, and last term was very I thought we had it last term. I just didn't realize time was running out. So it's a matter of just, in my point of view, it's not a matter of asking for something special. It's asking that the 9 or 10 employees from the city of Dallas be treated like all their local employees in the state of Oregon. That's what I'm asking for, and I'll answer any questions.
All right. Are there questions for Mr. Caesar? Dick, I have one for you. 9 or 10 from the Dalles, but we also have in here non-PERS employers. This is from you, I assume.
It is.
So tell us what this tells us.
Basically, there are most local governments, a few exceptions, do pay Social Security on their employees.
Mm-hmm.
And PERS, as you know, part of its responsibility with respect to its overall picture and its relation with the federal government is to track agencies that are public employers and who are on PERS. So they actually have a list of all of these agencies that are paying their employees Social Security and who are also not members of PERS. So these, to the extent that any of these groups here have a retirement plan, their retirees would be affected by this bill. Mm-hmm. Now, I need to make one more clarification, and that is if it's a police and fire retirement system, or the employees are police and fire employees, to stay outside of PERS, they have to pay equal or better than benefits than PERS does. Okay? So Portland Police and Fire, for example, is a big one, would not be affected by this bill because the way the bill is drafted on page 3, line 10, going on to line 11, it says, from a plan or system that is subject to ORS 237-635. So it does not affect those retirement plans that have to provide equal or better benefits. And that's, in a sense, a level playing ground, so to speak, because PERS got additional benefits, and they're taxable. Equal to and better must also have gotten additional benefits. And they're also taxing.
So the revenue impact, you show $460,000 in 03-05, $615,000 in 2005-07. That's obviously more than just the 9 employees in the Dalles. That's assuming the employees of these other districts that would fall into the same.
Yes. Okay. And you know, the data is very good.
Okay. All right, questions for Mr. Caesar. All right.
Mr. Chairman.
Mm-hmm.
I gave a letter I received from PERS, and I highlighted the part. I didn't want to just read that part out of context, so that's what I wanted to show you, that they said that probably the legislature didn't know that only 95% of the people were in PERS and there were 5% that weren't.
Right.
So I wanted you to have that, so I'm not reading anything out of context. I'm just trying to be...
I appreciate that. I was going to mention that just for the record, that we have this letter from Dave Amick. I guess it is of PERS from February of 1999. Just proof that you've been dogging this for a few years. Okay, thank you, Mr. Caesar.
Okay, thank you.
Let me close the public hearing for now, then, on House Bill 2698. That's all we had that scheduled for today. And let me open a work session on House Bill 2489, and if Dexter is listening and available to come on down the hall, if Dexter could join us, Dexter Johnson, that would be great. In the meantime, though, let's, Mazin, if you'll bring us up to date. And Charles, why don't you come on up to the table? And I see we've got some amendments before us today.
Yes, Mr. Chair, after all this sobering morning, I'm here to cheer you up.
Oh, Mazin, thank you so much. Everybody feeling better? Try again.
Okay. I'm here to cheer you up.
Chew us up or cheer us up? We're getting a lot of that these days.
House Bill 2489 has a -1 amendment, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. And this attempts to put the general in the power of attorney section of the bill itself, and also in the last citations of which ORSs are being amended, it puts ORS 9.160, which is more relevant to the certification or people with certification that could attempt to represent the person and who this applies to. And we have talked to Dexter earlier, if he doesn't make it. He was supposed to, he said, we'll be listening. But the idea that Dexter was able to check with the judiciary and with Dave Hendricks and found no problem or no conflict with the bill that is being considered there. The citation will not impact the different bill or how it will become if it either passes or doesn't.
Well, and I think the issue was the use of the word general in the in the statute. Kathy, will you please give Elsie a call and see if we can get Dexter down here?
Mr. Chair, the mention of the word general, as he says, it's not common, but it's more like common law, so it's not going to, in that essence, impact the other one or how you define
here, it. Here, oh, no, that's Paul. Okay, Charles, do you want to speak to this?
Certainly, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Charles Stern. I'm the Amhill County Clerk and I'm a chair of the Oregon Association of County Clerks Legislative Committee. I talked to Dexter about the bill. He called and had a couple questions. And I think when we had the public hearing, we talked a little bit about why the clerks talked about general versus the limited power of attorney, which is also an option for tax purposes only, that it was not our intent to open it up so that some out-of-state corporation, instead of obtaining professional licensed representation to use someone with just a limited power of attorney, but rather to meet the needs of those citizens who may are unable to do their own business and have a trusted friend who has a general power of attorney to be able to sign the petition and represent them before the Board of Property Tax Appeals when they're able to do all the other business that they may be needed to be done for that person. There's one other change in this from the original bill and also from my proposed amendments, and that deals with the notarization. Dexter raised the issue that under current law, many powers of attorney are not notarized. 2280 would change that, and I don't know its outlook in the Judiciary Committee, but under current law, you can have powers of attorney which are not notarized. There's provision that if you're going to record those in the deed records, then you notarize them, but you can have general powers of attorney without it. And so Dexter talked to me about this notarization issue, and I said, well, our intent was if this person already has a power of attorney notarized or unnotarized, that they'd be able to meet the business needs of that person, that principal person. And so I think that's why you notice that the notarization issue is deleted in the amendments.
Okay. That makes sense. So we're not around about creating a notary requirement for all general powers of attorney, if you ever would want to use them, since that's not, that doesn't exist elsewhere in statute. And Dexter, I guess I want, you and I had spoken, and we've gotten references now to you on the record from Mazin and from Charles, but also you're comfortable with this use of the word general in referencing power of attorney in the statute?
Yes, Mr. Chair. Dexter Johnson, Legislative Counsel Office. The statute, the ORS generally doesn't use the term general power, but instead just limits it at power. But I did discuss with this with Dave Hendricks, and it is a well-understood common law concept what general power is versus special power. And we're both comfortable with the use of that term.
All right. Then so am I. Any other questions for these folks? All right. Thanks, Dexter, just for putting that on the record. We're in work session. We have Dash 1 amendments before us. Representative Hass, thank you.
I move adoption of Dash 1 amendments.
Representative Hass moves adoption of the Dash 1 amendments to House Bill 2489. Is there any discussion? Any objection? Hearing none, they are in. Representative Hass.
Mr. Chair, I move we send 2489 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Hass moves House Bill 2489 to the floor with a due pass recommendation as amended. Any discussion on that motion? Please call the roll.
Representative Barnhart.
Aye.
Berger.
Aye.
Farr.
Aye.
Hass.
Aye.
Austin.
Aye.
Scott.
Aye.
Williams.
Aye.
Chair Shetterly.
Aye. House Bill 2049 goes to the floor. I'll carry that one and close the work session then on that bill. And with that, we are done for the morning. We're adjourned.
Okay. Thank you.